KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Recommendation to deny the move. The Seattle group also negotiated a backup deal with the Kings owners in an effort to sway the NBA Board of Governors to vote in their favor. We'll get an update on all the latest happenings on weekday in a couple of minutes. Boeing is delivering 787s again after a four-month halt while it fixed problems that led to smoldering batteries. Boeing announced a delivery yesterday to Japan's All Nippon Airways. Airline flights and deliveries were halted in mid-January after two battery incidents. Airlines have been slowly resuming flights of the Dreamliner. Ethiopian Airlines was the first to get the plane back in the air April 27th. United Continental Holdings is set to resume 787 flights again on Monday. Microsoft says a planned update to its Windows 8 operating system will be made available for free later this year. The update is meant to address complaints and confusion that have been blamed for deepening a slump in personal computer sales. Microsoft isn't saying what kind of changes will be introduced with the release of the new system, but the company plans to make a preview version available next month. The release of the final version is expected in time for the holiday season. Microsoft Corporation announced the update last week, but wouldn't say at the time whether consumers would have to pay for it. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
54 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Expecting showers today with a high of 62. Support for NPR comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, proud sponsor of StoryCorps, preserving history and celebrating American lives.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets' 9 neighborhood locations.
I'm Bernard Willett. It's 9:06. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The Seattle International Film Festival kicks off tomorrow night at McCaw Hall with a sold-out screening of Joss Whedon's new film version of Much Ado About Nothing by Shakespeare. We're going to talk with the folks who've booked more than 400 movies that are going to be shown in our region for the next 3 weeks. Later this morning, Robert Horton will cast his critic's eye on the festival lineup. The NBA's Board of Governors is set to meet at 11 a.m. Pacific time today to vote on whether to sanction the sale of the Sacramento Kings to a group of California investors or to give its blessing to Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer's historic offer for the team. Joining me now is Seattle Times reporter Bob Condotta, who's been covering the ongoing Hansen Group offer and the NBA response. Hi, Bob. You're in Dallas, right?
I am, yeah.
Can you recap what has happened in the last couple of days?
Sure. Well, if you want to go back to Friday, I mean, things really took a real turn on Friday when Chris Hansen announced kind of out of the blue that they were going to increase their offer yet again. They had made an initial offer in January for the team that was accepted by the Malou family, which owns it now. They increased the offer in April by a little bit, and then on Friday they increased it by another $75 million for the total value, bringing the total value of the team to $625 million. And to put that into perspective, the most ever paid for a team previously is $450 million for the Golden State Warriors about 3 years ago. So it's just, you know, it's just blowing all the financial precedents for something like this out of the water.
Well, they also added some other $75 million.
Saturday, yeah. Saturday news broke that they also made kind of a backup plan with the Maloofs to buy 20% of the team if their offer for the 65% of the team is not accepted, and that is seen as kind of another way of putting some pressure on the NBA. But also as potentially a backup way that Hansen could still get his hands on the team down the road. They also offered to pay a $115 million relocation fee, which is money that goes straight to the hands of each of the other 29 NBA owners, so roughly $4 million for each of them. And to put that into perspective, when the Sonics left in 2008, they paid just $30 million. So it's just another case of how aggressive he's being, he and Steve Ballmer. Obviously, Ballmer is hugely behind this as well, in trying to get the team and trying to just make a statement to the NBA how much they want to get the team and get the NBA back in Seattle.
As I understood it, the same relocation committee that voted 7-0 to favor the Sacramento offer met again on Monday?
They did. They met via teleconference on Monday, and the understanding is that they discussed kind of the new information. They did not make a new recommendation out of that. That was sort of left to interpretation of what that meant, and the interpretations of so many things in this are based on whether you live in Sacramento or live in Seattle. But
right.
In Sacramento, they sort of took that as, yeah, they're still going ahead with the 7-0 vote that they made before. You know, if you were in Seattle, you kind of thought, well, maybe they just don't have enough information now to say something new. So it was a little unclear exactly what that meant.
And I also heard that the NBA Finance Committee, was going to meet as well prior to the full Board of Governors meeting. I don't know if that happened or if that
happened. I'll be honest with you. I don't know for sure if that happened either. That was rumored about. There was some talk that was maybe going to happen on Tuesday. There was not anything yesterday, which I can vouch for, having spent about 10 hours in a chair in the lobby of the hotel here, where there was not much going on, and we didn't see a whole lot of people, and David Stern was not here. David Stern arrived early this morning, apparently, from San Antonio. They could. You know, everybody is here, so there could be meetings that people don't know about. The Finance Committee is simply five people, so they could be meeting to do something on their own. They could have met via teleconference or discussed this via email and taken a vote. But, yeah, it was never revealed if the Finance Committee made its own separate recommendation on this. And obviously the Finance Committee would be much more, just looking at the money behind it. And the money that Seattle is offering is so unprecedented and so much more than what Sacramento's is, that there was some thought that, you know, they might say that it's hard to ignore this.
Well, altogether, as I understand it, you or one of your colleagues totaled all the money that the Hansen Balmer Nordstrom Group has on the table, and we're talking almost $1 billion.
Yeah, I mean, if you include it's $406 million for the team. It's $115 million for the relocation fee, and then it's all the money they would be putting into the arena, which is $290 million out of their own pocket initially. So yeah, it does come close to that. And then that doesn't count. Then to throw in also about the $80 million or so that they have already paid for all the land down there. So yeah, it is a huge investment, and it's another thing that, you know, another way that they were trying to show the NBA how serious they are and make the case that, if they want to return the NBA to Seattle, now's the time to do it, because what they're offering and the political climate in Seattle might not be better than it is right now.
We're talking with Seattle Times reporter Bob Condotta, who's in Dallas awaiting the Board of Governors meeting, which is in about an hour Dallas time, if I'm doing the math correctly. Yesterday, Sacramento Bee reporter tweeted that he'd had a conversation in the hotel lobby with George Maloof, one of the current owners of the Sacramento Kings. And he says that they would work, the Maloof family, would work in good faith to build an arena in Sacramento if the 20% Hansen ownership deal went through.
Yeah, well, George Maloof was the one real interesting thing yesterday. He has been very secretive throughout the process, and then suddenly he was making tours of the lobby and talking to everybody. He seemed to, my take on what he said yesterday was he left no option off the table.
Wow.
He was asked varying things by everybody, and again, depending on what city you were from or what reporter you were, he basically told you, I think, what he thought you wanted to hear. You know, he told a couple of us Seattle reporters that his number one priority was still to sell the team to Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer, and wanted to see that through. He told some of the Sacramento people that if that gets denied, of course they would look into maybe selling the team to the Sacramento Group. I mean, they are going to come out of this with an awful lot of money, no matter what happens. They would prefer to have it be the most money, which would be the Seattle Group. But the whole reason they're in this predicament is because they need a lot of money and they need it fast. They've had some real financial issues, and so I think when push comes to shove, they won't turn down the Sacramento offer if it's there, because it'll still be a very attractive offer for them.
Bob, have you had a chance to speak to any of the other team owners who are not part of the relocation committee?
Yeah, I did. I did talk yesterday it's actually kind of an interesting twist here, but the man who is representing the Portland Trail Blazers is Peter McLaughlin, who is the president of the Seahawks, because mm-hmm. Paul Allen owns both teams, and McLaughlin is here representing him. So Allen himself is not here. They are under pretty strict orders not to say anything. McLaughlin sort of insisted he doesn't know a whole lot either. you know, that they'll get briefings on it and then make their votes here today. But they are under penalty of pretty serious fine. One of the best quotes of the whole thing came from Mark Cuban, who is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, who's never been afraid to say anything. At the All-Star game, he walked through the lobby and said, there's a lot of things that are worth getting fined for. He said, talking about this issue isn't one of them.
So what exactly do you expect to happen today?
Yeah, I wish I knew that. There's enough. My hunch is they will provide quite a bit of finality to this. This is the second time all 30 NBA owners have met on this, and they don't want to keep doing this. They don't want to keep having to fly to some city overnight and spend a day talking about an issue that doesn't necessarily have a whole lot to do with them. So I think there is some urgency to get this over with. If I had to bet, my bet is that the Kings are going to stay in Sacramento. They will probably try to figure out a way to tell Seattle to at least stay on hold and not just tell them that they're done and don't come talk to us anymore. That, you know, there has been the specter of expansion. They have denied that, but that's another thing publicly. You wouldn't say publicly you're considering expansion until you have to. You know, the minute you say it, then it completely changes the game. But I think they could be considering expansion. They could at least maybe throw that out there today as something they would consider more seriously if it gets to that. So my hunch is they will at least make final today the fate of the Kings, and likely that the Kings are going to stay in Sacramento.
Bob, are you tweeting out from Dallas what's happening?
I have been. I did tweet quite a bit yesterday. I haven't been tweeting a whole lot yet this morning, but Twitter is a really interesting phenomenon through all of this, because there's an awful lot of rumors and speculation out there, and people see something and interpret it a certain way, and it creates a whole new dynamic to covering something like this. But I will be tweeting like crazy here once everything starts to happen.
And where do we find you?
At B Condotta, so at B Condotta. And you can find all our tweets as well on the homepage of the Seattle Times Sports online, and I think just the front page of the seattletimes.com today as well.
Well, we'll be following you as well. Thank you for talking to us.
All right, thank you.
Bob Condotta is a reporter for the Seattle Times. He's in Dallas awaiting the meeting of the NBA Board of Governors and the decision that they make about the future of the Sacramento Kings. This is Weekday.
And of course, as soon as we get that information about what's happening with the Sacramento Kings, we will pass that on to you. It's 9:17. I'm Bernard Ouellette. The Seattle International Film Festival touts itself as the biggest film festival in North America. What do they mean by that? And what goes into putting together such a big undertaking? We'll find out in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Multiple Sclerosis Center at Northwest Hospital. The new MS Center offers comprehensive patient-centered care from infusion to rehab and diagnostic imaging with all services in one location. More information is available at uwmedicine.org/MS.
55 degrees in Seattle. The forecast says expect showers today with a high of 62. Tomorrow, clouds in the morning, then partly sunny with a chance of showers in the afternoon and a high of 65.
Did you know you can support KUOW through a planned gift? By making a planned gift, you help ensure that public radio remains available in our community for years to come. For more information on how you can make a planned gift to KUOW while receiving financial benefits today, go to kuow.org/future.
It's 9:18. When it comes to healthcare, why does the cost of a given procedure vary so wildly from one hospital to the next? And what does that mean for us consumers? We'll find out in about 10 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday. Tomorrow night, Seattle area cinephiles will turn out for the opening night of this year's Seattle International Film Festival. For, depending on how you count it, 39 or 40 years, SIFF has presented a potpourri of big movies, old classic films, edgy indie cinema, foreign fare, and this year's no different. Joining us with the festival preview, the three folks who are I suppose, the ringmasters in this circus. Mary Baccarella is the managing director of SIFF. Beth Barrett is SIFF's Director of Programming, this is Alphabetical, the Artistic Director of the Festival, Carl Spence. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in. I like to do things alphabetically the first time, and then we can throw your names around. Let me start, I guess, Carl and Beth, with you, with the big number, more than 400 films, more than 440 films.
447.
447. Yeah. Do you just every year decide that you're going to up it by 50 or so films?
No. We actually were trying to show less movies, and then we got too excited and ended up with more.
Well, a lot more, because weren't you in the 300s last year?
No. I mean, we have – actually, it's interesting. We have more features this year, and I think we have less shorts.
Or, we do.
So it's actually – so there's more features. So it's it was sort of a balance.
Is this 447 including everything?
Including everything. Short films.
Secret films we can't talk about.
The Secret Fest is back. Is there any kind of I should ask Mary. She's the person who runs the numbers. Do you tell them, no, enough, stop, that's too many movies?
Do you know, Carl, Marcy, I've tried.
Whoops. you tried to stop them, but it didn't work.
It doesn't work. They're geniuses. So, you know, the more they add and the films that we see are just amazing. So I try, but it doesn't work.
I know every time I've spoken with Carl and Beth in the past, the day after the festival ends, you're working on the next festival. But seriously, Beth.
Yes.
You know, how does the work start when you're going to lay out what's happening?
Oh, it literally starts the day after. Actually, it's already started. We have interns tracking the films that are in Cannes this year and that have played, you know, recent festivals, and we just sort of start looking for films. Luckily, we also have CIF Cinema Uptown and the Film Center, so we have the ability to show films year-round. So we just really just start.
So is there a framework that you're looking for a film that fits the festival or a film that you might put in one of your other screens later on outside of this 3.5-week window?
I mean, there is a loose framework, and also at this time of year, we're just looking at things and sort of everything's gestating, so we're not actually most likely inviting things for next year, but we're sort of adding them to our list, and it accumulates until we get around 5,000 films that we've discussed over the course of the year, and that's features, and which is sort of crazy. And the Cannes Film Festival is really interesting because we have a film that was debuting there this week, the opening night of the Unsrenergard, which will be closing our festival, The Bling Ring. So there are some things that we'll be showing this year that have just happened as well. But we already programmed our entire summer for the cinema. So we'll be, you know, we were working on that at the same time as the festival.
That's too much for me. I know it's not just Beth and Carl working on this. How many people?
There are a total of 25 programmers from locally and around the world that help us out.
Mary, do you get to have any input on that?
Actually, I'm pretty new, but they actually this year gave me a few films to watch. So I actually feel very much like a group, part of the group now.
Is there a framework that you give the watchers of the films? Is there like a checklist that they sit there and if there are things that don't fit, that film is tossed?
Yeah, they have a form that they fill out, and there's a rating scale. I mean, there's the biggest, most important thing is story. Really, is it a really strong story? And then you look at the technical aspects and all the acting, the directing, all those other pieces. But the story is really what drives us and really what excites us. If it's a strong story, sometimes you can overlook some of the other things. But really, that is what drives and makes any film really successful, is something that will grab you.
So how many films do you have to screen to get that golden one that gets the little seal of approval?
Hundreds.
Ooh, hundreds.
Really?
Yeah. Hundreds. Yeah. It's always such a great joy when you find that gem. You're like, oh, thank you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you have to watch the whole thing through if it's bad?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you watch every one of these movies?
Someone watches every one of the films that get submitted to us. It's filmmakers put a lot of their effort and their hearts into making the films, and, you know.
That being said, it depends on how you're seeing the film. If someone's paid us to watch it, then we watch it all the way through. If we're out in a festival or a market, then we might just walk out if we realize it's not for us. So it just depends on the environment, which I'll admit, because when you're in a festival environment, it's completely an industry screening, or I'll have a private screening seeing movies after movie, and I'll say, okay, next movie.
No. Of the three of you sitting at this table, Carl, have you been with the festival longest? And then
I have. Yes.
And how many years is that?
I started, it's almost back in 1994, although I haven't been
you
here.
You left for
I
a
left.
Left.
So I've been back for about 10 years.
That's a long time. And Mary has been here not 10 months, I don't think.
3 months.
3 months.
Yes.
So you are the newest employee.
I am
most
the newest
likely.
Employee. I'm
sure you have attended SIFT in the past, but this is a question for Carl about the evolution of this festival. It's been billed for as long as I can remember as the biggest festival in North America. I noticed this year we're saying the United States, but it's still a large and big festival with more than 400 films. We're talking about something that I don't believe any one person can see all the movies. I don't think it's physically possible.
No, it'd be impossible.
At this point, was it ever possible to take in the whole festival?
I don't know. I mean, in the beginning, the very first year it was because it was one screen. And so they showed two films a day, maybe three on the weekend. So it was when it started and it grew. I mean, I inherited this sort of beast as it was at one time, 30 days. Now we're more manageable, 25 days.
Oh, yes.
but it's really interesting. There are so many different things. So and most people see 2 to 4 films. So for the majority of people, they go to see what they want. We do have our devoted pass holders and some will see as much as 150 films. But it's really evolved, and it is interesting because Seattle is not the largest city in the U.S., but we have the biggest audience of any festival over New York and Los Angeles. So it's a pretty great distinction, I think, that actually we have an amazing film culture here in Seattle.
So Mary, it's called Seattle International Film Festival. Maybe you're just going to go by SIFF now because it's not a festival any longer. You've taken over a year-round operation with permanent screens. And so for you, what's the biggest challenge?
There's a lot. What they've gone through, and I say they because I'm so new, what they've gone through in the last few years has been unbelievable about the way that they had the Film Center now at the Seattle Center with a theater there, and then taking over the Uptown Theater. So the biggest challenge is to keep that going. And for me this year, seeing all this growth and how great it is going to be about the sustainability. We've been through one full year now with the Uptown, so we can see the trends and what that looks like. And I'd actually defer to Carl and Beth about the programming, because I think the programming, what they're doing over the Uptown, is amazing, because they're doing what they do for their mission, or what we do for our mission, in the art house films, but they're also bringing in the major films so both audiences can be exposed to all of this. So it's just amazing.
The Uptown will be taken over by the festival itself for the 3.5 weeks, right?
Absolutely.
And you guys are all over the region.
We are.
Did you add a cinema this year? I know Renton is a location. East Side.
We're holding our own this year, so we're not adding any new venues. We are in Kirkland and Renton, in addition to Seattle and Queen Anne, downtown, and the Capitol Hill.
How many screens? These rotate in and out, but how many altogether?
6 in downtown Seattle that are running consistently throughout the festival, and Renton and Kirkland, as well as the Film Center, Cinerama, Triple Door, some other one, like single screening or event locations.
So now you guys have these permanent venues, as Mary was just saying. Do you ever sit down and go, what are we doing? Why are we doing this?
Well, I think what really drives us is our mission to create experiences to bring people together to discover extraordinary films. And it's really working, although the trend is that people are going to see movies less in theaters. We're seeing an increase in our audience, a significant increase. So with the festival and year-round, we're reaching
That's
over 250,000. So it's really about the experience, because people are always going to want a reason to leave their house, I think. So we're believers in the cinema, and we're really looking at building that art house audience back.
I know that tomorrow night, I'm assuming that this is sold out, the opening night, is Joss mm-hmm. Whedon's new Shakespeare version, filmed in his house, I believe.
Yes.
Much Ado About Nothing. But besides the big names, Bling Ring, all these sorts of things, one film that each of you is most excited about on the bill. I'm going to start with Mary.
The one I'm most excited about is a documentary, The Trials of Muhammad Ali. It's about when he was Cassius Clay, and when the whole race, religion, Vietnam War kind of came together, and how that kind of changed the conversation we were having on a number of levels at that time. So that's the one I'm looking forward to.
Okay. What about you, Beth?
I am really looking forward to Peter Greenaway's new film, Goltzius and the Pelican Company. I've been a Greenaway devotee for more years than I would like to admit publicly.
And he's coming.
And I get I get to meet him. I mean, this is like the film geek. I get really excited because I get to meet him. And it's a stunning film, but I can't wait to see it on the big screen.
Okay. Peter Greenaway. Carl's trying to winnow down quickly.
I have so many, but this one film is an unexpected comedy from Japan. You don't actually think, Japan has a huge number. It's called Key of Life. And I never expect to be so amused and laugh so much with a Japanese film, but it's a screwball comedy caper where this out-of-work actor who's thinking of offing himself has a screw up, and he takes the identity of a hitman by mistake.
Okay, screwball comedy. I'm thinking Tampopo. That was sort of screwball-ish. So, cast your minds back.
Yeah, I mean, it's strangely touching. It's clever, and it's pretty funny.
Well, there's 447 offerings, so there's probably something for everyone. You can find out. The schedule's kind of broken down into categories,
moods,
genres,
moods.
Yeah, everything at SIFF.net, and you can peruse there. That's where you're going to find everything. Carl Spence is SIFF's artistic director, who's been with the festival for many golden years. Beth Barrett is the director of programming. I think together you two run the programming choices. Mary Baccarella, the new girl in town, is the managing director of the festival and the permanent screens that are there as well. Festival kicks off tomorrow night at Macaw Hall. It wraps up June 9th with Sofia Coppola's The Bling Ring. And again, for more information, go to SIFF.net. Good luck, all three of you, for the next 3.5 weeks.
Thank you, Marcy.
This is Weekday.
As we just heard, there are literally hundreds of films showing at the Seattle International Film Festival. We got a few recommendations, but over 400, that's a lot of movies, so we're going to get even more expert guidance. Film critic Robert Horton brings us his SIFF recommendations later this morning at 10:20. In the more immediate future, scrutinizing the cost of healthcare. That's next.
Support for KUOW comes from BECU, the member-owned not-for-profit credit union, offering a range of home loan products, including conventional and jumbo mortgages. Details at BECU.org, an equal housing opportunity lender, federally insured by the NCUA.
55 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 62 this afternoon. Showers expected. Looks like showers overnight, too. We're going to drop down to 52. Tomorrow, Thursday, clouds in the morning, partly sunny in the afternoon, continuing chance of showers, and a high of 65.
Support for KUOW comes from Evergreen Speech and Hearing Clinic in Bellevue, Kirkland, and Redmond, celebrating Better Hearing and Speech Month with free hearing consultations to help transform lives through the resolution of hearing loss with hearing instrument technology and customized care programs. More information at everhear.com.
It's 9:31. We'll hear the latest in the case of the American diplomat being accused by Russia of being a spy in the news at 10.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Last week, the federal government released new statistics that compare hospital costs for 100 treatments or procedures that are covered by Medicare. And those numbers revealed something that most consumers already know. There's no rhyme or reason to how much a hospital charges its patients. Could cost you twice as much to have pneumonia in Seattle as it would in maybe Great Falls, Montana. And then what are we supposed to do with this information anyways? Can you price an appendectomy the way you price a new car? Joining us to talk about hospital costs, health care, and consumers is Aaron Katz, principal lecturer at the University of Washington School of Public Health. Nice to have you in once again.
Good morning, Marcy.
First question, why did the feds decide to release this information now? Because I think they've had this for a while, haven't they?
As far as I know, this is the most comprehensive and systematic publication of hospital prices. And I don't actually know why they decided to publish this now, although it's consistent with a move by the federal government to try to make everything about the healthcare system more transparent. That's the code word now, and including prices. And it's part of a push to give consumers more information, patients more information, to help them make choices.
These were specifically tied to Medicare procedures. Does that mean that if I have Medicare, the treatment for pneumonia costs different than if I wasn't old enough to be on Medicare?
Oh, yeah, for sure. the federal government has the best information they have is about Medicare, because of course the federal government runs Medicare, so they collect this information, they can compile it. But if you have private insurance, the prices that that hospitals charge the private insurance are likely to be by and large higher than these prices, but also very different.
And is that because each insurer negotiates a price separately with each hospital?
Correct.
Okay. So it's not like a car in that sense, that if I go to the Ford lot and look at a Focus, I believe that's sort of the baseline car at the Ford dealership, and the sticker says $22,000 and more if I add mats or air conditioner or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's my point that I leap off from. These numbers that the government released are not that kind of a sticker.
Well, in fact, they are a little bit like that sticker price, because we all know that if you go to the car dealer and you walk around the lot and you look at the sticker price, you know you're not going to pay that sticker price. You know, you
right.
go through that routine of, you know, negotiating and then sitting
yeah.
and waiting for the guy to go to the manager to ask if the – so it is similar in that way. But what's not similar is that this is talking about a whole bunch of different car dealerships. And if you were to go to the Ford dealer in Seattle and the Ford dealer in Detroit, the sticker price would be essentially the same.
Right.
But the sticker price is not the same for open heart surgery between Seattle and Detroit. And that's among the many quandaries that we have looking at these numbers.
Well, so you use that word transparency, and this effort to be transparent only makes it a little more opaque for me, is that I have many questions. One is, why is it more expensive to have, say, open heart surgery one place than another? Is it the same reason a house costs more in one place than another, or is it just sort of a random, we think it should cost $55,000 in this city and it's $22,000 over here?
Well, I think the simple answer is we don't know why these prices vary that much. I suspect that there are historical reasons going way back into sort of prehistory of hospital prices, that the difference in prices from one hospital to another had to do with the different costs that went into doing the surgery, the costs of the facility, the, right. all these, you know, all hospitals are different, the kind of staffing, et cetera. But that was a long time ago. And as far as I think anybody can tell, that whatever rationale there were for different prices for the same procedure across hospitals has long since evaporated. And so they don't make sense. But also the prices don't make sense in another way, that these prices don't represent what anybody actually pays except for maybe some uninsured people. These are prices that the hospital charges whoever's paying the bill, but almost any insurance company, Medicare, business like Boeing negotiates a much lower rate than those prices.
Another question I have when it comes to hospital choices, you may be in a network of doctors, as I am, and my doctor has hospital privileges at particular hospitals and not at others. And if the particular hospital that my doctor frequents charges more than one that she doesn't, do I have the option to choose the cheaper hospital for a procedure?
Well, I mean, yes, you have that option. The question is, what's the benefit to you of doing that? So the transparency is really only that we're talking about right now is about the price.
Right.
Right? But when we're dealing with our bodies, you know, we're not talking about cars anymore. We're not talking about shoes. We're not talking about cornflakes. We're talking about our bodies. So what we've got to figure out is at the point in time we're making a decision, if we know there's a cheaper place to have a procedure, are we willing, is that worth it given whatever we know about the likely outcome,
right,
the benefits to our health? And I think this is where relying on in a trusted relationship with our doctor, we,
right.
I mean, that's the reason to have these relationships, is because we trust that person's judgment. And if our doctor says, you know, this surgeon at this hospital is really good, my patients have done really well with this person, I mean, that's going to weigh pretty heavily,
sure,
in my choice. Now, of course, you and I are insured. And
right.
So the price consequence isn't as great. But nonetheless, I think that this transparency business about prices masks the complexity of the decision that we each make when we're dealing with, you know, our kids or our parents or ourselves.
We're talking with Aaron Katz of the University of Washington School of Public Health. He's a health policy expert. So this, again, it seems that the direction that we're going under the Affordable Care Act and the push for dollars and cents data is that trust relationship isn't really quantifiable in the way that these kinds of numbers are. So it's apples and oranges, isn't it, in a way?
I think there is an inherent contradiction, because the model, the sort of economic model that giving people more information so that they can make better economic choices, that economic model it's very difficult to insert in that model the very important factors that play into our decisions, and like the relationship we have with our primary care provider, or the trust we put in friends and family, mm-hmm, who may have had similar experiences, and you know, that weighs heavily on us. So I think the model is there's an assumption that if you just give people more information, they'll make better decisions. But there's many problems with that. One of them is that the big ticket items, the things that cost the healthcare system a lot of money, tend to be non-discretionary. So people's decision making is very limited, mm-hmm, often emergent,
right,
which means that if it's me, you know, you're hit by a bus, you're not going to be price shopping the emergency room.
Nope.
So there's all these other things that go into these decisions that, as you say, are not quantifiable.
And yet the decisions are at every level. It doesn't even actually matter what political persuasion you are. Both Republicans and Democrats in Congress are talking about, you know, choice and the fact that it's the consumer who should be making the choice. And I was in preparing to talk to you, one of the things I was looking around for is the equivalent of a consumer credit counselor. Is there a consumer health care counselor, or is that an industry we're going to see emerge, because it's confusing for us?
Well, in fact, there are roles like that, both for the purpose of choosing an insurance plan, and the Affordable Care Act has created or will be creating, mm-hmm, a whole cadre of navigators to help people navigate, particularly in these new marketplaces or insurance exchanges. But also for individuals, there's long been case managers to help people make choices about what kind of services they need and where to get those services. That case manager has been particularly important for older adults and for people with disabilities or chronic problems. But this is going to become more important and a bigger role as we move towards these things called medical homes. We've heard these terms.
Yeah.
That is to try to get your family doctor's practice to provide more comprehensive services, act more like a team that's helping you rather than individual providers.
And this is also going to be an issue, as I understand it, the Affordable Care Act depends on young people enrolling in something. I believe we're mandated to choose something if we're not already insured. So This is a segment of the population you might have been insured by under your parents, and I think up till 26, if your parents have insurance, you're still covered. But when you're 26.1 day, you've got to pick something on your own, and that's not something that healthy 20-somethings have done.
Right. So this is – right. I think this is one of the unknowns and definitely a challenge of the Affordable Care Act is to get people – who otherwise wouldn't be making these decisions, wouldn't be paying attention to health insurance and different plans and what do they need to do so. I think we just have to recognize that that's going to take time to take hold. It's really creating – I mean, I think this is one of the important values of the Affordable Care Act is it is trying to create a new cultural norm. The cultural norm is we should have insurance. And that's a shift from where we've been. And like any change in cultural norm, this will take time, and we've got to give that time. But it is going to be a challenge. We'll see how this rolls out beginning this January.
And that's when the health exchanges in Washington State come online?
Right. In fact, enrollment will begin this fall. So we'll probably begin hearing we'll get bombarded with public service announcements and ads late this summer and this fall. And also that's when Medicaid expansion, which if the legislature does approve it during its special session that started this week, and everybody expects that it will, Medicaid expansion will also begin January 1st.
So back to that question of where a person turns for whether to pick the right plan or Medicaid, where should I go to look for this information?
Well, the State Health Benefit Exchange, and to be honest, I can't remember the formal name they came up with, but if you Googled that, you would find their webpage. But presumably, there's going to be a portal, a webpage that will probably know very well in a few months when we're bombarded with these ads. There's going to be a web page to go to, which for people who are looking for insurance. And remember, this is mostly individuals,
right?
And there are going to be these navigators, and I'm not sure any of us know exactly how they're going to work. But there's, I think, going to be lots of ways people get assistance.
Well, we'll tell you more when we know it. That's it. That's the news business. Aaron Katz is principal lecturer at the University of Washington School of Public Health. Thank you very much for your help in trying to demystify what still seems pretty mysterious.
My pleasure. Thanks, Marcy.
This is Weekday. This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Yesterday, Hollywood star Angelina Jolie created an international stir with her very public New York Times revelation that she'd had a preemptive double mastectomy. Jolie's mother died an early death from cancer, and Jolie discovered that she herself carried a gene, BRCA1, that made it likely she'd develop breast cancer. Jolie's op-ed prompted many other women to come forward to talk about their own decisions about breast cancer prevention. Like Jolie, Seattle resident Lynn Resnick underwent a prophylactic double mastectomy late last year. Thank you so much for joining us, Lynn.
Oh, thanks for having me.
When did you actually have the test for the BRCA1 gene?
It was a September afternoon. I had gone in for my annual mammogram, and at Swedish, you can schedule an appointment that they actually read your mammogram. It's a longer appointment. And I was growing really frustrated because, you know, whoever invented the mammography machine really didn't understand that it hurts. And so after, I think, something like 10 views and my glaring frustration to the radiologist tech, the tech went back and spoke with the radiologist, and the radiologist summoned me back into his blackened office, and, you know, he pulled up my images on the screen and was like, okay, so here's what's going on, Missy, you know, and explained with his really calm candor there's this, you know, and he's sort of identifying various spots on either breast. And then he pulled out my chart and said, look, given your family history, in my opinion, it's not a function of if, it's a question of when you'll have breast cancer. To which I quickly said, well, yeah, I mean, my mother had breast cancer when I was 15. My grandmother died from it within a week of diagnosis when I was 12. So, yeah, I mean, I sort of have thought that way for a long time. He quickly turned around and summoned one of the nurses to bring the, you know, here's the cancer prep packet. And it was, you know, filled with surgeons, oncologists, I mean, every sort of piece of information assuming I had cancer. And the one piece of information that he was most adamant about was giving me the card for the genetic counselor at Swedish. And so that was sort of what precipitated the conversation after, I mean, many times my doctors have suggested, because I've been in this high-risk group, that I go in for genetic counseling. But because I'd crossed into the 40 decade, they you know, sort of took that harpoon and said, now go.
So what does the testing involve? What do you have to do?
It involves a really lovely phlebotomy chair, a kind phlebotomist, and, you know, 10 days of waiting. It's a very simple blood draw. It's not anything extraordinary.
So that you sit down in a chair, they take some blood, and then you wait.
Then you wait. It's sent to Salt Lake City, you know, in a FedEx package, and then you wait. There's a series. Interestingly enough, it's an expensive test. It's something like $4,000, and I happen to be an Ashkenazi Jew. And so there's a set of three BRCA markers that they've identified that are typically associated with Ashkenazis having breast cancer. And so they ran that panel first, which came back negative, interestingly enough. And then they went and ran the full battery of mutations. So there's something like 1,000 or 1,200, some extraordinary number. And that's only for the BRCA 1 and 2 mutations. Then there are other genetic mutations which are associated with cancer, but this was specifically for the BRCA 1 and 2 test.
$4,000, is that covered by health insurance?
It is, and I think, I don't know what my tidy sum was at the end, but I know it was under 1,000, which is still no chump change. So it was a discussion my husband and I had, but again, sort of given my age, given my family history, and there's a little, you know, there's a curve that between 35 and 40, the incidence of cancer, it's relatively flat. Between 40 and 45, you start to see an ascent. Between 45, you know, to say 50, 55, it's, you know, it's sort of like we're climbing Mount Rainier. So the decision to do that made sense because at 40, I'm a bit younger. My ability to recover from surgery, God forbid that should be the case, would have been, you know, would be easier. So there were a lot of factors that played into my mind about getting tested.
You talked about being able to recover from surgery as a possibility, which you ultimately decided to go through once, after all this testing, they discovered there was a mutated gene that would predispose you a very high percentage, I think, you know, over 80%, wasn't it, that you were likely to develop breast cancer?
Yeah, so Bob, the genetic counselor at Swedish, called me up. It was 10 days after I went in for the blood draw, and I happened to be at home reading a book, and called me up, and he's like, guess what? Today's the day I'm going to tell you you have a deleterious mutation. And, you know, the counseling session went something like this. Okay, so by agreeing to come in here, you know you're going to learn information about the stats. And so the first one he told me, which was hard, really hard to wrap your head around, was that ovarian cancer risks are something between 50 and 67% if you carry the BRCA 1 or 2. Mm-hmm. And then for breast cancer, it's anywhere from 60 to 87%, and they can get more specific depending upon what mutation you have. And so when he rang me up that afternoon and told me, here's, you know, yes, you have a deleterious mutation, he said, yours is a known friend, meaning, in fact, if you have this one, you're at that high risk rate. So there you have it.
So how long in between your counseling session and the decision that you were going to undergo this preventive double mastectomy?
I'm one of those people that's a little bit curious because I've had this family history. I was in a high risk group for many, many years. And so I think I started getting the counseling, as it were, when I was a late teen, early 20-something. You know, being given advice like, okay, here, you know, eat a veggie fish diet, mm-hmm. try to you know, try to have babies before 30 if that's something you want to do. Nurse them, nurse the crap out of them. And so every recommendation that my doctor made then I employed. And then I think at 25, the discussion started about, okay, you need to have your first mammogram 5 to 7 years before your mother's onset of breast cancer. And my mother had breast cancer. I think she was somewhere between 35 or 37. I was
wow.
a teen. And, I could do the math, and I think I tried to avoid doing the math because it's one of those things like, oh, that won't happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I started having mammograms in my late 20s, and by 30 I was having annual mammograms. So then the cadence became like, you're going to have an annual mammogram. Oh, and by the way, because you're in this high-risk group and you have dense fibrous breasts, we really need you to come in and do an MRI annually. And so the truth of the matter is I've been doing all this surveillance for so long, and I would go in and I would, you know, do the research and think about, here's what if this comes back positive? How am I going to react? And so I already knew if, God forbid, the decision, you know, needed to be made, I would do a double mastectomy. I really wanted to do everything I could to avoid chemo. Because to me, watching dear friends go through chemo who've been ravaged by cancer just seemed more traumatic than chopping off my boobs.
It sounds like you never did second guess this decision.
I didn't, no.
This is, 4 months since your surgery?
5.5 since my double mastectomy and 4 months since my reconstructive surgery.
What did you think yesterday when you heard about Angelina Jolie's op-ed in the New York Times?
Truthfully, it was one of those moments. It was late, and I happened to be online doing a little surfing, and I was like, "That bee stole my line," and then I was like, "Oh no, it's great because here she is, Laura Croft, known for her being bodacious and booby," and I was like, "Well." Now I don't have to be such a chicken about talking about this and feeling, because there's this weightiness that comes with making this decision. I had countless friends come to me and go, oh my gosh, you know, and then in hysterics say, I can't believe you have to go through this. And I'm like, yeah, it sucks. It's part of my identity, you know, having these breasts, but it's not the end of the world because I'm choosing life. I'm the decider, capital D, and I can make this choice and hopefully be here for my children. And the part that's heavier is to think that my two children have this genetic mutation. But hearing Angelina talk about it and say all, really recount her experience as almost the exact same as mine was, I mean, really, I felt a tremendous amount of levity.
That's Seattle resident Lynn Resnick. She had a double mastectomy last winter. She spoke from her home earlier this morning. This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. I just say, too. That's the sound of baby lambs with their moms. Oh, so sweet. Oh. Our listener, Paul, recorded the lambs and their mothers. He was working on a sheep farm in the Skagit Valley. Oh, let's hear them some more, Bernard. They're just so cute.
Oh, yeah, that's pleasant.
Oh, I can't tell if they're happy or hungry. Oh, little lambs. Well, we, as always, want to know what interesting sounds you're listening to in your neck of the woods. Record 30 seconds of the sound and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and make sure that you include sound of the day in the subject line. Now, Bernard, the sound of the day up in British Columbia is the Liberal Party celebrating their survival, or some might say their upset victory. The incumbent Premier Christy Clark is going to keep her seat. And last week, Vaughn Palmer was on our show saying, oh, no, the new Democratic Party is going to overthrow the Liberals. And they're up by 9 points. And
now he's feasting on crow.
He is indeed, although, you know, he's pretty good-natured about it. But he's going to talk about the results of this election, which surprised every pundit, which just goes to show perhaps you shouldn't trust any of us in the news business.
Mm-hmm.
We're also going to talk with Robert Horton about his picks for the Seattle Film Festival. You heard earlier, 447 movies. You know, what's a...
Yeah, we could use a little help weeding through that.
We will weed through that, and John Talton will be with us talking about Boeing and Microsoft and all the glories of the world of business in the Northwest.
It's all happening this hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 9:59. How's President Obama doing? What do you think? What's he doing that you like, and what's he doing that you don't like? Let us know right now by calling 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. KUOW's Ross Reynolds hosts that conversation today during the noon hour. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting Puccini's one-act Sister Angelica, together with The Human Voice, a one-woman drama from Francis Poulenc. Two new-to-Seattle stories together on one double bill, May 4th through 18th at McCaw Hall. Details at seattleopera.org.
From Netflix to your cell phone, TV networks have more competition than ever, but they still have the edge.
Broadcast networks still aggregate eyeballs, still have the biggest audiences, still have live sports such as the Super Bowl.
I'm David Green, reporter Kim Masters on how networks hope to get your attention this fall on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Dermatology Associates, recruiting adults with a confirmed diagnosis of plaque-type psoriasis for participation in a clinical research study of an investigation.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.